It's Tuned to Yesterday, delivering programs from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark Livonier, and coming up in this hour, Romance from the Campbell Playhouse, featuring Orson Welles and Helen Hayes, who had just come off of a revival of her well-known play, Victoria Regina. A month after this broadcast, she would be in Ladies and Gentlemen for 105 performances on the Great White Way. This particular broadcast features an offbeat love story called Peter Ibbotson, heard on CBS on September 10, 1939.
Of Campbell Soups presents The Campbell Playhouse. Orson Welles, producer.
Good evening. This is Orson Welles. Ladies and gentlemen, your attendance, your generous encouragement makes possible another season of these broadcasts. The actors and musicians, the engineers and sound technicians, all the craftsmen and artists who contribute their efforts to this program want me to tell you how grateful we all are to all of you. In behalf of these ladies and gentlemen and of our sponsors, the makers of Campbell Soups, I promise you the best year of radio plays we know you how to produce. The best stories, the very best that we can find from the theaters and from the motion pictures, and once a month, our choice of the best novels. For these, the best performers we can find, the really great stars for our guests from Hollywood and from right here on Broadway, besides our own star company of Campbell Players. Here's Ray Collins, for instance, and Agnes Moorhead, George Koulouris, John Emery, Everett Sloan, Edgar Berrier, and Eustace Wyatt. Here's Bernard Herrmann, who composes and arranges all our music with his own fine orchestra. And finally, here's the best news I could have for you. Standing beside me at this microphone is an actress. Well, she won't let me try to say how much I think of her. And I don't need to anyway. This isn't her first or second time with us. She's closed our last season. You remember, she came back from Europe to open this one. And this year, she's going to make this program her regular radio theater. Tonight, the week after next, and whenever she can make it, she's going to be with us. That's my news. Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Helen Hayes. Well, we began last season with a bestseller, and this year we open with another. Rebecca. It's going to be a motion picture, and you've seen tonight's play on the screen. We've done it before on the Campbell Playhouse, in a shorter version a few years ago, with Ann Harding, Gary Cooper, and John Halliday. Constance Collier, with John and Lionel Barrymore, made a memorable stage success of it some 20 years after it had become one of the world's great love stories. If anybody ever wrote a stranger, more haunting romance than Daphne du Maurier's, it was her own grandfather. It was George du Maurier, the Victorian cartoonist, who sat himself down at the age of 57 and surprised everybody, and especially himself, by writing a novel which became a classic. And Miss du Maurier's grandfather's novel deserves its indelibility in English letters, believe me. Here's a tale as persuasive, as ingratiating as your favorite waltz. It carries intact into posterity the lilt and fragrance of our own grandfather's memories. His remembered world of romance, lovelier than ever. And happier, too, from the distance of 1939. Ladies and gentlemen, we present tonight the beautiful, the well-beloved, Peter Ibbotson, with Helen Hayes as Mimsy. But first, before we begin, welcome back to the Campbell Playhouse. And now here's a word from Ernest Chappell.
I'd like to ask you to think back for a moment to the days when you were a youngster, when Mother called, "Come to dinner," and you knew there was chicken, how happily the family gathered round that table. Do you recall? And when you saw the tender chicken meat just fall apart under Father's carving knife, remember how anxiously you waited for your plate to be passed? That's why I say, just as sure as you like chicken, you like Campbell's Chicken Soup. Won't you make a point of having it soon? And now we bring you Helen Hayes and Orson Welles in Peter Ibbotson.
My name is Peter Ibbotson.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're about to hear the story of a man who was my friend.
I have been for many years an object of pity and contempt to all who ever gave me a thought. To all but one. To all but
He died early this year in a cell at Wormwood Jail, in which he'd been an inmate for over 28 years.
Contempt to all.
He had been originally sentenced to death over the murder of a near relative. Later, this was commuted to imprisonment for life.
Yet of all that ever lived on this earth, I have been, I think, the happiest and most privileged. As you will see, as you hear my story to the end.
For a great many of the facts you're about to hear, I can personally vouch. Of the supernatural parts, there is not much I can say. You must remember that the man who wrote this was for a time incurably insane, and there seems to be some doubt among authorities of the prison as to whether he had ever completely recovered. At the risk of being thought to share his madness, if he was mad, I want you to know that I, for one, believe him to have been sane and to have told the truth all through.
As you will see, as you hear my story to the end.
Come in, sir. Come in, sir. You'll be quite comfortable here in the parlor. There is a balcony. There is even a couch here by the window to lie down if you are tired.
Thank you.
You no doubt have been in Paris before.
Yes, I've been in Paris before.
Oh, it is much changed, is it not? It has now grown larger, more of a town, more beautiful. The emperor has done great things. Yes, you must be very pleased with Paris.
Pleased? Why should I be pleased? When I lived here, there were gardens with green trees and hedges and grass and flowers. Now, what do you see? Little mean yards and villas like a London suburb.
Oh, but it is so much more modern.
Yes, of course. Tell me, how long is it since the houses in the Street of the Pump were pulled down and rebuilt?
Oh, it is done since a long time. I myself have the hotel here for 4 years. And when I came here already, the old houses, the old, rubbish were already gone.
Rubbish, you call it? I see.
Now, if you will say what you desire for dinner, we have tonight a very special blanket of veal.
Thank you. I don't feel like dinner.
But, sir, you...
Just leave me alone. I'm very tired. If I want anything, I'll call you.
Of course. Thank you, sir.
And he left me there by the open window. It was that day that we had our first dream. I'd lain there for a while, thinking of all the things that I'd seen that day, and remembering my life as it had been in London and here in Paris when we were children. I'd lain there by the open window, I can't tell you how long, remembering the years gone by, that beautiful French garden under the warm June sun where I began my conscious existence. That afternoon in Paris, in Madame Seraskier's drawing room, when I first saw Colonel Ibbotson.
Here he is, Colonel. Gogo, this is your uncle.
Step over here, boy. Come on.
Now then, Gogo, don't be shy, dear. This gentleman's come all the way from London to see you.
So... this is the boy whose father blew his brains out trying to get rich quick, eh? Hardly looks like a French frog at all, do you, boy? Speak up, Peter. You can speak English, can't you? Come, let's hear you say, how do you do, sir?
How do you do, sir?
That's better, you young scamp. Now then, straighten up, meet your Uncle Ibbotson. Colonel Ibbotson, that's my name. It'll be yours from now on.
You mean you're going to take him away, Colonel?
I am indeed, ma'am. Leaving for London tonight. I'll make a gentleman of him, an English gentleman. Not like that French frog father of his. A man who couldn't even provide for his wife.
Colonel Ibbotson.
I think of what I offered that woman. Do you mean to tell me, ma'am, she never told you about me? Her cousin. Never told you, poor thing, that she and I...
Please, Colonel. The boy.
Yes, the boy. Well, ma'am, can you have him ready to leave tonight?
Yes, if you wish it. He can be ready. If you'll excuse me, Colonel Ibbotson, I'll start getting his things ready.
Of course, dear lady, of course. Gad, what a woman. Well, boy, say something. What's the matter? Are you dumb?
I don't know what to say, sir.
Oh, aren't you glad to be going to England?
I don't know, sir.
Don't know? Well, I'll be dashed. Well, not that I blame you, you little rascal, with a lovely lady like that next door to make over you. The way she had her arms around you, boy. By George, I'd have given something to have been in your place myself. Quite the young Lothario, aren't you, boy? Aren't you, huh?
And so, on a beautiful June afternoon, sweet with roses and lilac, and gay with dragonflies and butterflies and bumblebees, my happy childhood ended as it had begun.
Gogo, when you go away and you can't see me for a long time, for years and years, will you forget me, do you think?
Of course not, Mimsy. Why do you think that?
Well, I don't know. Boys are so different from girls. I expect you'll remember me all wrong if you don't forget me altogether.
Oh, what rubbish you do talk.
Go. You must come now, dear.
I don't want him to go.
Come, dear.
Mother, I don't want him to go away. Go.
And as our carriage started, I remember I looked back and saw for the last time the house where I was born. And standing at the iron gate, I remember Mimsy, with her thin, pale face and close-cropped hair, sucking her thumb, trying not to cry. A moment later, our carriage had turned the corner, and they had vanished forever. And so it was that I left my childhood and went to England with my uncle. And there I'd lived for 12 long years until that day in June, the day of our first dream. I came back to Paris and fell asleep by the open window in that little parlor of the Tête Noire Hotel. I remember it was evening, Sunday evening in Paris. I'd seen it over and over again, just like this in the old days. From where I lay, I could see the cafes and the little square between the bridge and the park. The air was full of the scent of trodden grass and macaroons and sweet French tobacco blown from the park, of gay French laughter and the faint sound of music. 12 years I'd been in England while my uncle tried to make a gentleman of me. An English gentleman like himself. On my 21st birthday, he'd sent me to his tailor for a dress suit. After that, he took me out with him into society. That was where I met her. I was at Mrs. Dean's. Mrs. Dean was a lady to whom my uncle was at the time especially attentive.
Why, Mr. Ibbotson, what's the matter? What are you staring at?
That lady. That lady who's just come in.
Oh, so you too, Mr. Ibbotson. You've fallen a victim to the epidemic of admiration?
Who is she?
Don't you know? That's the Duchess of Towers.
Duchess of Towers.
Have you never heard of her? She's one of the kindest and most beloved women in London. Dear Mary does so much good. Yet her own life has been very sad.
I don't understand.
She married the Duke of Towers, somewhere abroad, I believe. He was charming enough for a while. Now there's no one in London will speak to him. Yet she remains so loyal to him. Come, let me introduce you to her. I want you to know each other. She's really one of the most charming and delightful women.
Charming, charming evening.
Most delicious.
I heard that your grace was in London.
Your grace, it's a wonderful thing you're doing. That new hospital you're
found. Oh, thank you. You're so kind. If you only knew what happiness it gives me.
Mary, I'm so glad you were able to come.
I wanted to see you, my dear. Mary, I want you to meet a young friend of mine. Mr. Peter Ibbotson, the Duchess of Towers. How do you do, Mr. Ibbotson?
Oh, there you are, Your Grace. If you'll allow me to take you in to dinner. There's something about that new charity idea you want to...
I was the Home Office. I'm calling.
Oh, Peter, what's the matter? You seem tongue-tied.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mrs. Dean.
Well, you did want to meet her, didn't you? What a strange boy you are. You mustn't be afraid to meet people.
Mrs. Dean, it's not that.
And seeing her like that, I just couldn't. She's too beautiful.
Why, really, Peter?
Ah, Mrs. Dean, I can see you're trying to entertain that nephew of mine, the moon calf. Come on, wake up, boy. Stop scooping through the door at that fair one in the room beyond. Poor fool. The desire of the moth for the star, the night for the morrow. I'm afraid you've not inherited your father's prowess as a Don Juan.
Don Juan? Why, he always speaks of his father as the most devoted husband.
Ah, yes, of course, yes. He speaks of that Frenchman, Pasquier. Yes, of course, of course. But I can see that you, Mrs. Dean, being a woman of the world, have already guessed a certain...
Liberty.
Oh, dear lady, be discreet. Not a word, I beg you. I wouldn't have it known for the world. But as you seem to have caught the likeness...
Liberty, for heaven's sake.
We were young, his mother and I, and spring, you know. Spring in Paris.
I don't believe
that. Of course, of course. Well, that's what you have to say, Mrs. Dean. But tonight, before I sleep, I'll write you explaining everything. Peter himself will bring you the letter. Won't you, Peter?
Why, yes, sir.
That's right, my boy. Here's a chance for you to make up for your clumsiness. Remind me, I want you to take a letter to Mrs. Dean tomorrow. A very private letter, you understand?
Yes,
and
sir.
And I want you to deliver it yourself, Peter.
Very well, sir.
Now, dear lady, if I may have the pleasure of your arm, que voulez-vous? This is the call of youth, and what is youth, sweet lady, without love? L'amour, l'amour, si tu, si bon, si ravissant.
L'amour. I'd left my uncle's house after that, left it determined never to return. And I was back in Paris. So it was that that evening, tired and saddened, I'd come to the hotel. I lay there by the open window with evening coming on, thinking sadly of things I'd seen that day. A crumbling wall, a stump of a tree, a rusty iron gate. All that was left of my dear, familiar world. From below, I could hear the noise of laughter and the faint sound of music. And down the street, an open carriage was driving towards me, coming closer and closer under my window. There's a lady in the carriage by herself, and as she glanced up at my window for a moment, as in a flash of summer lightning, her face seemed to light up with friendly recognition, with a sweet glance of kindness and pleasure and surprise, a glance that pierced me like a sudden shaft from heaven. It was the Duchess of Towers. And a moment later, the carriage was out of sight. I lay there a long time by the open window. In the square below, the voices were still, and it was getting dark. And then it was that I fell asleep. Perhaps it was my weariness, or the heat of the thunder in the air, or the strange sound of the distant, familiar music.
Hendrick?
The Duchess of Towers. I can't. The gate is closed.
The gate isn't closed, Mr. Ibbotson. You only think it's closed because you're not dreaming true. Don't be afraid. Give me your hand and come in with me. You see, it's so easy. It's an old iron gate to a garden, that's all.
Am I awake or am I... It's so strange. I know I'm asleep. Lying by the window in the parlor of the inn.
Yes, and just now from your window you saw me driving by. So don't be afraid. And of course you're asleep, Mr. Ibbotson, and dreaming. Otherwise, I'd not be talking to you like this, you may be sure. Hold my hand, Mr. Ibbotson, and come with me. Now. What do you see?
I see a garden. I hear someone playing.
You know that tune?
I seem to have heard it before, long ago.
You see, now you're dreaming true, because I have you by the hand.
Dreaming true?
Yes, and now you must try again. I'll hold your hand and help you. Give me both your hands. Where are you now?
I'm in a garden looking over a wall. Somehow I expected the wall to be very high, but it isn't. I find I can look over it easily.
You can see everything quite distinctly, can't you?
I can even smell the scent of the flowers.
You can see and hear and smell, but you mustn't touch ever flowers or people or anything. Now try again. What do you see?
I see a tree, an old apple tree, and I see two women sitting under the tree. One of them is knitting at a table, and oh, I know that table. There's a small boy there in an old-fashioned suit of clothes. He has a book in front of him, which he's reading, and by his side is a little girl with close-cropped black hair and a thin, pale face, peering over his shoulder. Could I speak to them?
just for a moment. Mother! Mimsy! Madame Sarovsky, eh?
It's no use. They can't hear you. You must remember that all the things and all the people in this garden are dead and gone by. If you try to touch them or speak to them, it blurs the dream like breathing on a window pane. I don't know why it does, but it does. With you and me, it's different. We're alive and real. That is, I am, and you seem to be real too, Mr. Ibbotson, by the grasp of your hands. Though why you're here and what business you have in this, my private dream, I still don't understand. No living person has ever been in it before. I can't make it out. Still, you're very welcome here, Mr. Ibbotson, if it amuses you to come. Especially as you're only a false dream of mine. For what else can you be? And now I must leave you. But if you want to stay on here in this garden after I've gone, you're very welcome to that, too. If you can.
Your mother will be wondering where you are, and the dew is beginning to fall.
Oh, Mother, just one more story. You promise.
Oh, please, Madame Sarovsky, one more story.
Very well, one last story. What shall it be this time?
Tell us about the white cat.
No, the Sleeping Beauty.
How about Prince Charming and the Fairy Princess?
Oh, yes,
Prince Charming, the Fairy Princess.
Well, once upon a time, many, many years ago, when the world was a younger and better place than it is now, there lived a king and queen who had one son, and his name was Charming. And when he grew up, the king, his father, and the queen, his mother.
I had awakened. There were voices in the passage.
The Duchess will be quite comfortable in the parlor until the storm passes.
Thank you, and will you see that my coachman and footman are dry and comfortable?
Yes, madame, I will see myself to your orders. I'll carry out. Thank you, madame. You are too kind.
The Duchess of Towers.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't know there was anybody here. Why?
Yes, Your Grace.
You are Mr. Ibbotson, are you not?
It's very kind of you to remember me, Your Grace.
Oh, please don't let me disturb your early evening nap. You were sound asleep, weren't you? Confess.
I'm sorry, I must have dozed off.
Oh, don't apologize. I fell asleep in my carriage myself just now until the storm awoke me. And then I had the coachman pull up at this inn because he was getting wet and the horses were frightened by the lightning, poor thing.
I think I saw you drive by just now from my window. Do you often come to Paris, Your Grace?
Whenever I can steal away from London and the season and the rush, even for a day, I come across the water here to Paris.
I love Paris, too.
Strange that we should meet here in this little inn. I didn't know that anybody knew of it. At least not English people, I mean. Mr. Ibbotson, this winter when I saw you at Mrs. Dean's...
Oh, I'm afraid I stared very rudely at you. I was hoping you'd forgotten.
I remember it very well, Mr. Ibbotson. You know, that evening, in a strange way, you reminded me of a little French boy I once knew who was very kind to me when I was a little girl and whose father you happened to be like. But then I met you and heard your name and... Afterwards, they told me you were a young English architect, and from that, and from what I hear, a very promising one.
Well, I was once a little French boy.
You? Mr. Ibbotson.
Yes. Later, I had to change my name to please a relative and become English. As a child, this is where we lived, here in Paris.
What an extraordinary thing. What was your name then, when you were a child?
My father's name was Pasquier.
Pasquier? Gogo, Pasquier.
How did you...
Don't you know who I am? Gogo.
You're...
Yes.
Mimsy. Mimsy Sarovsky.
Oh, my dear. My dear. So it was our garden you were looking for. And our house.
It's all gone, Mimsy. All pulled down and built over and changed.
I know.
It drove me nearly mad. And then just now I saw them all again and... Oh, no, that's foolish. That was a dream.
A dream?
I'm trying to remember what happened. I came up here. I was tired and disappointed. I sat by the window there... And then you drove by in the street below.
Yes.
It got dark and there was thunder in the air. Then I must have fallen asleep and I suppose it was seeing you just before that. But I dreamed I was in our old street. And I just got to the avenue gate and the gate was closed. And then suddenly you were there.
I was there?
Yes, in my dream. And then you came towards me.
I came towards you and held out my hand and told you that you were not dreaming true.
I couldn't quite make out what I was doing in your dream, and you gave me good advice.
About not touching anything or picking the flowers, or the dream would blur. Mr. Ibbotson, it's not possible. Two people can't have the same dream.
You led me inside and you told me how to dream true. And you showed me the garden.
And my mother was there. And your mother and you and I as children under the tree. Mr. Ibbotson.
Oh, please, Mimsy, don't
Ibbotson,
go.
Mr. Ibbotson, I can't tell you what it has been to me to see you once more. I thought you had died long ago. I feel as if I were dreaming now. Except that all this seems so impossible and unreal, and dreams are never unreal. I don't know if I shall ever meet you again. You will be often in my thoughts, but never in my dreams again. That at least I can command.
But, Mimsy...
No, no, believe me, it mustn't be, Mr. Ibbotson. I am not free, and this must be our final farewell. I can't tell you how I feel about you and always have felt. You shall... We shall often think of each other, but we can never be together in our dream. I wish you all the good one human being can wish another. Goodbye, Mr. Ibbotson.
Nothing the matter, sir.
Don't you want your supper?
No, sir.
You're a queer one, you are. You don't eat hardly nothing. At night, you sleep like a baby. And all day, you sit here at this table, a-scrawling away for dear life. One sheet or another. Didn't used to be that way.
There's no harm in it, is there, sir?
No, there ain't no harm in it if it makes you happy. But if I was you, Mr. Ibbotson, I'd try to eat a bite. That's what I'd do. Well... Anyhow, I'll leave the dish here. Maybe you'll change your mind. I'll come back for it later.
So. Now I'm alone again. And go on with my story. You know about my enchanted youth and of the garden in Paris where Mimsy Sorosky and I played as children. I've told you of my coming to live in England with my uncle, Colonel Ibbotson, of my return to Paris, and of my strange meeting with the Duchess of Towers. Now, with an unwilling heart, I must come to the great calamity of my life. Soon after my return to London, I called one evening upon my friend, Mrs. Dean.
Why, dear, you're back. Where have you been?
In Paris. I returned this afternoon.
You left so suddenly. Is it true you and your uncle quarreled?
I'm afraid so.
I'm so sorry.
Tell you the truth, I've been feeling rather sorry about it myself.
So you're going to make it up?
I hope to. Mrs. Dean, there's one thing I want you to tell me, something I've never quite understood. That evening at your house, my uncle made certain remarks, certain allusions to my father.
Peter, I assure you, he was just talking. He didn't mean anything.
Mrs. Dean, that wasn't the first or the last time my uncle has spoken in that way about my parents.
Peter, may I ask you a question?
Yes, of course.
Your father and mother were a very devoted couple, were they not?
They loved each other at first sight, and they kept right on loving each other till the day they died.
And your uncle, Peter? Did they ever talk about him? Were they friends, he and your parents? Did your mother like him? Well?
Not much, Mrs. Dean.
Was there any particular reason for your mother's aversion to the Colonel, as far as you know?
I really don't know.
Peter... I have a reason for asking you this.
Well, as a matter of fact, Mrs. Dean, there was a reason. Colonel Ibbotson, he's not really my uncle, you know. He's my mother's cousin. He'd once been infatuated with my mother, rather desperately so, and she had to refuse him 3 times before he gave up and went abroad to India. Later, she met my father, and they fell in love.
Peter, do you know the exact date when your uncle went to India?
Oh, yes, certainly. He sailed with his regiment, the 43rd, 15 months before I was born.
That's what I thought. Then he isn't your father.
What do you say?
Your uncle is a villain, Peter, and a liar. He's done you and your parents a fearful wrong.
Oh, Mrs. Dean.
Peter, you know your uncle's handwriting and his crest.
Oh, yes.
But do you remember bringing me a letter from your uncle the morning after you were at my house?
Yes, I remember.
Well, this is the letter.
Now that I know what a foul lie it is, I thought for your own sake and the sake of your parents' memory, you ought to know what it says.
Mrs. Dean.
Listen. Here's what he writes. Poor fellow. She was charming but foolish. We were cousins, much thrown together. Both so young and one so beautiful. Happily, an unsuspecting Frenchman of good family was there who had loved her long, and she married him just in time.
Crockett.
Oh, it's you, Mr. Peter. Why, we ain't seen you in a dog's.
Where's my uncle?
Why, the colonel said he's upstairs. He's in his room, but it's late.
I got to see him.
Well, there you are in an alley, Mr. Peter. I never saw you in such an alley before in my life.
Uncle!
Oh, well, the traveler returns. My beloved nephew. Why this honor? You come like a dutiful nephew to humble yourself, to beg forgiveness?
Uncle, I've come to have a talk with you.
Here, what are you doing? Unlock that door.
Not until I'm finished, Uncle.
Here, what the devil?
Sit down, Uncle. You wrote Mrs. Dean I was your son.
It's a lie. It's a lie. Who told you so?
She did, just now.
It's a lie. A spiteful invention of a cast-off love. I suppose she told you that, too, that I'm finished with her. Now unlock that door and get out of here, you pitiful green jackass, or I'll have Crockett
you.
Throw you
ring that bell, Uncle. It won't help
get
you.
Get out of here.
Look at this letter. Do you know your own handwriting?
A forgery.
Get down on your knees.
What are you doing, boy? Take your hands off my throat. Crockett.
Get down on your knees.
Let me go.
Go on down on your knees and confess the truth.
Confess.
You're a coward. Confess you're a liar. Confess what you wrote in that letter about my mother was a lie. But I'm not your son.
I confess.
All right now. Get up.
Go over there to that table. Try and undo some of the harm you've done.
Write that neither my mother nor Mrs. Dean were anything to you, but... Uncle!
Now then.
Put down that knife.
I'll tell you, you fool. Of course they were. They both were. Mrs. Dean and your mother.
Put down that knife.
Of course I wrote that letter. Every word of it was
put
true.
Put down that knife!
I'll show you who's master here, you parasite, you murderer!
Oh, Uncle! Down!
You have heard the verdict of this jury. Before sentence is passed on you, have you anything to say in your own defense?
No.
The sentence of this court is that you be hanged by your neck until you die.
That you, Chaplain? I'm glad you've come.
Mr. Robertson, last night you spoke of some message to a friend. You care to give it to me now?
Very good of you, Chaplain. Here it is.
What is it, Mr. Robertson? There are certain prison regulations.
I don't think this will interfere with regulations. It's a miniature of my father and mother.
Who is it for?
For Mary, Duchess of Towers. And you won't send it, will you? You'll take it to her yourself.
I will, Mr. Robertson. I promise. No message goes with this.
Just tell her it's from me. She'll understand.
Very well. Mr. Robertson, we haven't much time. Will you kneel down with me and pray?
Pray? Yes, Chaplain, I'll pray to whatever's left in me of inherited strength and courage. I'll pray that it may bear me up just a little longer so that I won't disgrace myself on the gallows.
And I'll pray the dear Lord to put a light in the window and leave the door unlatched for a lost and weary child.
This is the way, ma'am. Down this way.
Is this his son? Is he in here?
What's that? Oh, don't let them come in. Let me alone, I beg of you. Let me alone.
Chapman.
It's the governor.
Come in, sir. And you, ma'am. Come in.
Peter, we have good news. Tell him, sir.
Mr. Robertson,
The Home Secretary has just commuted your sentence to life imprisonment.
No! No! I tried to be brave. I tried to keep my courage up by thinking of the time I was going to die.
Oh, Peter, you mustn't take it this way.
You think you're being kind, but you're not. You're not!
May I be alone with him, do you think, for a few minutes?
Well, Chaplin and I will wait.
Oh, thank you very much. Peter, won't you keep on being brave?
I'm young and strong. I'll probably live 50 years. 50 years of misery and torture. Alone. Why couldn't they have let me die?
Peter, I have a message for you. From someone you love. Yes. Yes, from her. It's she who gave you back your life.
Mary?
Yes, her husband died last week and she was away. When she heard the news of your trial, she came back to London. She was with Home Secretary for over 3 hours tonight, pleading, arguing, fighting as she never fought before. And in the end, you see, she won.
Yes. And the message, please.
Tell him his life has just begun.
She said that?
Yes. What answer shall I take back with me?
Tell her to try it, if she can. Not to think of me as I am here. A murderer. But as the little boy she used to play with so long ago.
Is that all, Peter?
Yes, that's all.
Now I must leave you. Let you have some sleep. Lie down here. You look so tired.
I couldn't.
Oh, but she wants you to. Oh, I forgot. That was the rest of the message. Tell him to sleep and dream true.
Dream true?
She said you know what she meant.
Mimsy.
What's that?
Nothing. I'll try, Mrs. Dean. I'll try to sleep.
There now. Let me put this rug over you. There. We can't have you catching cold.
Thank you.
God bless you, dear boy. Sleep and rest.
Thank you.
I'll come again. Often.
You've come.
Mary!
I've been looking for you and waiting for you here. Why haven't you come sooner? Oh, I suppose you couldn't sleep or you couldn't dream.
I've tried. I've tried so hard. Ever since that terrible night, I've not been able to dream true. Not once.
Poor Peter.
Mary, I swear to you by all that I hold most sacred, by my mother's memory and yours, I never meant to take my uncle's life.
As if you need to tell me that. Look, I'm holding your hands, and I can see into the very depths of your heart.
Mary, he came towards me with that long knife. And he went down, and I struck him again and again.
Hush, hush. Each time I pass my hand across your brow, I wipe away some bitter memory, you see. Listen.
No, the Sleeping Beauty.
How about this, darling, the Fairy Princess?
Oh, yes, the Fairy Princess.
Well, once upon a time, many, many years ago, when the world was a younger and a better place than it is now, there lived a king and queen who had one son. And his name was Charming. And when he grew up, the king, his father...
Do you hear? His name was Charming. And when he grew up...
I'm a failure. My life is finished.
Hush, hush. Give me your hand to
hold. No, it's true. It's true. All those high hopes we had when we were children, all crumbled to dust. I wanted to fly up in the sun because you asked me to. I wanted to succeed beyond all men because you wished it.
Peter.
There never has been anyone in the world but you. Never a ghost of a woman. Never even a friend until that night when I first saw you in London. Till then, I scarcely lived at all. I fed on scraps of remembrance. I was waiting for Mimsy to come back again.
And when she did come at last...
Oh, for a time I was too blind to recognize her. And now I don't know which of the two has been the sweetest. You or she. Both have been my life.
And shall be, Peter. And shall be.
Charming, beautiful fairy princess were married and lived happily ever afterwards. And that, my dear, is the end of the story.
Now, come on, children. This time we really are going home. Go, you take the basket.
Mother, are you sure they lived happily ever afterwards?
Yes.
Forever and ever?
Yes.
Forever and ever and ever?
Yes.
Oh, Gogo, I'm so glad, aren't you? I'm so glad they're happy together.
You see, Peter, from this moment we belong to each other. Nothing can ever come between us again. During those hours which people call night, when our bodies lie in the half-death known as sleep, in spite of your prison, we too shall be together. I am free now. Each moment I can steal from my waking existence will be devoted to you as long as we both shall live. I shall make you happy, dear. I shall make you forget. We shall go back together and see everything that either of us has ever loved or taken presence in. Peter, isn't such a life, our life, sweeter than death?
There really ends my story. Little has happened to me in the 25 years that have passed since that fateful morning. Little that men can see. In the outside world, those years have seen many changes, I am told. A new generation and wars and inventions that have done much to alter the face of the earth. But to me, they are merely 25 years of the most impossible happiness. 25 years. Seems like a single night and like a thousand years. So little has our world changed, and so much have we seen and felt and done, Mary and I together, in that busy, enchanted quarter of a century. Mary beside me, never a day older, in the enchanted home of our childhood. And if ever this should change, if ever the day should come...
Mary! Mary! Where are you? Where have you gone? Mary! Where are you? Mary! Where are you? Why don't you come to me? Why don't you come to me? Can't you hear me?
Can't you hear me?
Mary!
There he is, off again.
How is he tonight, Warden?
Not so well, ma'am. Talking very strange he is. Seems to think he's lost someone. He's getting weaker too, ma'am. Doctor says he can't last more than a day or two.
Peter. Peter, don't you know me? Warden, would you mind leaving us alone for just a little while?
Certainly, ma'am. I'll be just outside in case you need me.
Thank you.
Mary. Mary.
Where is she? Where is she?
Peter. Peter, I want you to be brave and bear what I'm about to tell you.
She's dead, isn't she? Isn't she? I knew it. She didn't come to me last night in our dreams. And we've met every night for so many, many years.
She sent you this. It was the last thing she did.
Too weak. Read it to me.
Soon again. The fairy princess.
That what she said? Thank you. Soon again. Soon. Oh, I'm so tired, so tired. If I could only see them once more. The garden. And the flowers and Madame Sarraskier playing. So tired. So tired.
Peter, didn't you know I was near you?
Mary, you've come back to me. Oh, my darling. I couldn't have waited any longer.
Hush. I know all you've been through, Peter, by the touch of your hand. Does the touch of my hand tell you nothing?
Only of your great love for me. And that's enough.
You've no idea how difficult it has been for me to come back to you, Peter, even for a few moments. And even now I can't stay very long. It's like holding on to the windowsill with one's wrists.
But since you died, Mary, I haven't had one single...
Every thought you had, my love, since I died, I know already. You will know it. You'll feel it. All in a moment, just as I did. And the world, the foolish world, will call you dead. And you will only have begun to live.
I can't understand.
And I can't find words to tell you. Language is such a poor thing. But where I am, it is all eye and ear and the rest in one. And oh, so much more besides. Where I am, I hear the sun shining on the earth and making the flowers grow. And the birds sing and the bells pealing for life and death. Happy, happy death. If you only knew it, Peter. The sun is shining on moons and planets, and the very stars are singing.
What does it all mean?
It means, Peter, that nothing is lost. Nothing. We on Earth are only poor little grubs. Our body is the cocoon we spin ourselves from our early life. And at last one day it bursts, and we fly away with our memories about us like great wings. That's what we are, Peter. Memories that never die.
And shall we be happy? As happy as we have been.
We shall never be parted for a single moment.
That's all I want.
And think of it. Here there are battles to be fought and races to be won, but no longer against each other. And the good and the bad and the worst and the best are all mixed up. Only the good comes to the top and the bad goes to the bottom. Out of sight and out of mind, forgotten. And everywhere about me, there seems to be an ever widening where perfection is. In a moment, you will wake and I must leave.
Oh, don't leave me, dearest.
Too very soon. Goodbye.
Oh, no. No.
But not for long. There's no sadness in bidding you farewell, because I know that you will come to me. Time is nothing. A few hours till the dawn breaks and the shadows fly away.
But don't go, Mary. Mary, help me. I can't see. Dark all around me. Mary. I know now what she meant. About the darkness. The shadows. And the dawn. The light. The light.
My friend, Peter Ibbotson, died in Wormwood Jail at the age of 67. After his death, I had the melancholy satisfaction of seeing him in his coffin. The splendor of his dead face as he lay there will haunt my memory until I die.
And now, Orson Welles has something to say to you.
Actors are sometimes asked which they prefer, the radio or the theater. Well, theater is a word that means more than it used to mean. Theater is rolled up on celluloid these days and shipped off in cans to the ends of the earth. Theater comes to you wherever you are when you tune to this station at this time on this day in the week. Our job is to make it good theater if we can. Nowadays, nobody in the theater is foolish enough to think they can keep the theater alive just by putting on plays in the city of New York. We're all of us out trooping again. It's called reopening the road. Now, the road means all the 48 star-spangled states of America. It means everything on this continent except a certain little district with a big name, Broadway. People write songs about it. The show folks, Main Street, we love it. It's where the plays come from. But ladies and gentlemen, we know they mustn't stay there. And we're going to bring our plays to you. All you have to do is buy some tickets and give us a place to hang our scenery. But of course, there aren't enough of us for everybody. Not even everybody wants to see a play. We'll do our best. But the radio is going to be our biggest auditorium. We think it's going to help us keep the theater worth keeping alive. Radio is theater. The Campbell Playhouse is your playhouse. Accept, please, with our compliments, a season subscription ticket to another year of first nights. I promise you first companies. Our sponsors, the makers of Campbell Soups, are your hosts. This station, this time, Sundays. And I've got a lot of stories I think you'll like. Next week, for instance, we're doing the Pulitzer Prize play, Our Wilderness. It's about ordinary people, but the play isn't ordinary. I can't tell you the story now, but I'm pretty sure you'll be interested in what happened to the Miller family on 4th of July of the year 1910. Mark it down for Sunday evening, September 17th, 1939. And the week after that, Helen Hayes plays Kathy in Wuthering Heights. Because, as you know, Helen Hayes has adopted us. Ours is the only radio program she will play on this season, and she promises to be with us for every broadcast she can possibly manage. Here she is, ladies and gentlemen. Miss Helen Hayes.
Orson, I'd like very briefly to say how happy I am to be back on this program, which seems to me to be radio at its very best. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe Orson Welles is making with his productions a uniquely important contribution to the whole institution of radio. It's tremendously exciting, of course, to be associated with that contribution. And I'm looking forward with more pleasure than I can tell you to my appearances at the Campbell Playhouse.
Thank you, Miss Hayes. You make us very happy. And thanks for your performance tonight. Now it's time to say goodbye. Ladies and gentlemen, remember our wilderness next Sunday. Until that time, our sponsors, the makers of Campbell Soups, and all of us on the Campbell Playhouse remain, as always, obediently yours.
The Campbell Playhouse on Tuned to Yesterday from September 10th, 1939 on CBS, bringing the curtain down on this hour of romance on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden era. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.